Hey, welcome to Metamorphosis, a podcast designed to help medical students navigate their medical careers. This episode is part of our reflection series, where we zoom out a bit and consider our medical journeys through the lens of those who have a little bit more hindsight. My name is Mike.
And I'm Aiden.
And today we have a really special opportunity to pick the brain of veteran physician Dr. Paul Thiessen. Dr. Thiessen has been in clinical practice for over 40 years, during which he was medical director of the intermediate nursery at BC Women's Hospital, as well as the spinal cord clinic at BC Children's Hospital. In addition to serving on boards for the Canadian and BC Pediatric Society, he was instrumental in establishing the ward at Women's Hospital that is devoted to perinatal care for mothers experiencing substance use. Dr. Thiessen, thank you so much for joining us virtually today.
Oh, I'm happy to do it.
Do you want to just start off by telling us a bit about who you are and what your path through medicine looked like?
Sure. Yeah. So I am a general pediatrician who has spent his career strongly focused on newborn medicine and on the care of children with spinal cord injuries and spinal cord anomalies. I've also worked a lot with the Canadian Pediatric Society in their teaching outreach issues, and I have done a journal club for 10 years for the CPS along with a colleague in Montreal. So, brief background on how I found medicine, or how it found me. And I guess I'd have to say that my experience was sort of the latter. I was born into a family that had been agrarian for about 500 years, as far as I can tell. And I was growing up on a farm in southern Alberta, and my family were quite poor, and we didn't have running water in our home. And so my mother had heated up a large container of water for the laundry and put it on the floor. And she thought I was safely secured in the other room, and I wasn't. I was 18 months old, and I fell into this, sat into it, basically. And fortunately, I was wearing a diaper, and I sustained about a 30% burn. And in those days, that degree of burn was considered to be incompatible with life, or at least most people would die if they had more than a 30% burn. So I was rushed to the local hospital, which was in Taber, Alberta, which is about 30 miles away. And my parents were then told that this looked pretty grim and that I would likely die. And I didn't. They kept a vigil, and I obviously lived. And throughout my childhood, I was obviously very conscious of it because my parents were very proud of the fact that I'd lived, obviously. And so they would often show my burns to family or friends who visited and like just pull up my shirt and say, here, this is what we're talking about. And I had pretty nasty scars, which I still have. And but I wasn't very interested in what had actually happened as a child. And when I was about 11, my mother sat me down one day and felt that I should have the story out and that she should explain to me exactly what happened. And so she did. And she talked about how they were told I'd probably die and that they waited for my death. And she said, and you know, despite the fact that you were so ill and were going to die, the staff were all so kind and generous, and the doctor in particular, whose name was Dr. Muir, he was just a wonderful man. Well, that conversation stuck very firmly, and I kind of decided on the spot that I would be a doctor. And I know that because I have a little notebook in my possession where I wrote in my 11-year-old hand, when I grow up, I'm going to be a doctor, nothing else. And so I have met a number of other people in medicine who have been pushed strongly in that direction by some family medical crisis or disaster, and I was certainly one of those. And so I never really changed my mind. I then went to the University of Alberta in Edmonton for my medical school training, and graduated in 1974. And I had a rotation in my final year in internal medicine with a very, very good doctor as my tutor, mentor. But right back to back with my internal medicine rotation, I did pediatrics. And the contrast couldn't have been more stark, from dealing with elderly people in congestive heart failure and things like this to children, young children and infants who in many cases had infectious diseases, because there was still a lot of meningitis and pneumonia around. Our bacterial vaccines hadn't been invented yet. And so we dealt a lot with the acute infectious diseases from which children usually recovered. And so after I'd been doing pediatrics on that rotation for a few weeks, I thought, I kind of like this. And the histories are way shorter. You know, that seemed very attractive to me. And so I decided to do pediatrics. Now, in my medical school class of 114, there were, I think, either 12 or 14 of us who decided to do a straight, which is a straight internship in whatever we were going to do. So I went right into pediatrics, whereas a lot of people did a rotating internship, which had a lot of strengths to it because you basically did a year in a hospital where you did all the different services, surgery and internal medicine. And but I did a straight, so which meant when I was finished, I could only do pediatrics basically. So I then did my first 2 years of pediatrics here in Vancouver. And of course, all of your life decisions are influenced by a lot of different factors. And in my case, my in-laws had just moved to Vancouver from the prairies. And the first time we visited them when I was in third year medical school, I took one look around Vancouver and says, hey, I think I'd like to live here, or we'd like to live here. And we never changed our mind. And so I then applied to UBC to do my pediatric residency, and I did my first 2 years here in Vancouver, and then I really wanted more exposure in an academic center, and so I applied to and was accepted at SickKids and at Montreal Children's, but I didn't speak French. Again, one of those things in life where when I was in grade 9 and we had to choose a language in school, my uncle was the German teacher. And so guess what I took? Exactly. And he was a really nice guy and I liked him, so I never learned any French. So I went to SickKids in Toronto and did my senior years of my residency at SickKids. Now, that is an unusual thing to do nowadays, to jump around and go to different institutions, or at least it's much less common than it was then. And so doing my senior years at SickKids was a very formative experience because the atmosphere was so academic. And I really, really enjoyed that after I got over the trauma of the first month where they're always grilling you and asking you questions on rounds and making you state your opinion in front of everyone else.
That sounds thoroughly uncomfortable.
Well, you know, we don't do that much anymore. You know, that style of teaching sort of fell into disrepute. And I find sometimes we go to much greater lengths now not to make anybody feel uncomfortable. But can you imagine in a grand round with 200 people present, just suddenly like they're discussing different cases and suddenly the presenter just says, well, what do we think of this X-ray? Dr. Thiessen, are you up in the stands there? Could you please tell us what you think of this X-ray? And in front of 200 people standing up and trying to speak your mind. Yeah, it was. So I did my senior years at SickKids, and there was opportunity to stay and fill the chief resident role at that time, which at that time was still an actual one person. Nowadays, the chief resident job in any hospital seems to be a committee of people. It's not one person. But I didn't. I came back to Vancouver and I did a year of neonatal training because I had been asked before I went to Toronto whether I would join a particular pediatric practice here in Vancouver. And I enthusiastically agreed. And that practice did a lot of neonatal medicine because the senior partner was the head of the nursery at the Old Grace Hospital and then at BC Women's Hospital. And so I joined that practice. And so I did a whole year of neonatal training when I returned from Toronto to Vancouver. And so I did a total of 5 years of post-medical school training before I went into practice. And so our practice has always been heavily focused on newborns and still is, although we do general pediatrics, which covers all the fields from behavioral to, psychiatric stuff, learning. And so I've done a pretty broad range of pediatrics over the course of my career.
So to your point about having a pretty broad scope of practice, could you give us an idea of what some of the biggest shifts were over the course of your career?
Well, in one sense, that's pretty easy to answer, in that we've moved very strongly from focusing on infectious diseases to focusing on behavior and learning and all of the what have sometimes been referred to as the new morbidities. That's been a major shift. So in the early years of my practice, and, one of the things I did in my career, starting right from the beginning, because this was modeled to me by my senior partners, was I kept track of every consult that I did in the office, because I had to always make sure that I had dictated a letter to the referring physician. And so I would write down the patient's name, the diagnosis, and then when I dictated the letter, I would tick in one box. And when I reviewed the letter before it was sent out, I ticked in another column. And so I had a record of my whole career's consultations, what all the diagnoses were. And it was certainly very apparent as you go through these books that you went from, follow-up for meningitis and pneumonia and da-da-da-da to attention deficit disorder and behavior problems and learning difficulties. And so there was a big swing away from organic disease, which I have often used that illustration in a limited scope for people who are vaccine hesitant to explain to them how, some diseases have actually disappeared in the course of my career, that we can hardly teach a resident how to do a lumbar puncture anymore because nobody gets meningitis. And that has really sunk in for some people who are vaccine hesitant, saying, look, folks, some diseases are gone. You'll never know somebody with polio. I have actually seen two cases of diphtheria because when I went to the Ukraine in the 1990s, their vaccine program had really lapsed in the confusing era before the fall of communism. And I actually saw several children with diphtheria. I even saw a child who died in Uganda from tetanus who wasn't immunized. So that was a big, big shift in the course of my career.
How do you see it changing in the future, in the next 10 years or so?
Yeah. Well, I think that, I think in some sense, for the present time, the die is cast, and that behavioral and learning pediatrics is a huge segment now, which is there to stay, I think. We call this developmental pediatrics. And that segment of pediatrics is going to continue to flourish because we have defined so many more ways of approaching these issues. And medicine has become very strongly entrenched in how we manage children with behavior and learning problems. So that was a big change.
So just to change gears a little bit here, something we know about you is that you have been involved in various international health outreach missions throughout your career, like your project in the Ukraine. I was wondering if you could touch a little bit on the impact these had on your career as a whole.
Right, sure. Yeah, I don't know why I became so curious about international health at an early stage, but I did. And again, probably it was through the influence of a couple of people I knew through the Canadian Pediatric Society who had done extensive work overseas. And it made me very interested to see how this works and, what is medicine like in other countries? And so I started by doing sort of 2-week volunteer stints in Honduras and Ecuador through an organization called Medical Group Missions. And their objective was to provide short-term care for people who are ill in small towns and villages in Honduras and Ecuador who didn't have medical care. We brought dentists with us, and they would be kept incredibly busy because there were so many people with terrible dentition in these places. And and from then, I learned of a project run through the University of Alberta, and that was a natural connection because that's where I'd done medical school, called Osvita. And after the fall of the wall in 1989, there was a lot of medical confusion in the former Soviet Union countries. And there were some strong connections from the University of Alberta with the Ukraine because there are a lot of Ukrainian immigrants in northern Alberta. And so this generation of immigrants then became very keen to help their fellow Ukrainians in Kiev, especially, which is where most of the teaching was done. And so I volunteered to go over and teach. It was entirely a teaching kind of commitment. I don't mean in classrooms, although we did some of that, but mostly it was on ward teaching of the pediatricians there to help them. They were completely cut off from the West, so there was no contact with the medical Western literature at all. And so they were still doing things that we had given up many years ago, like one of the most amusing illustrations when I was doing a session on streptococcal infections and their various manifestations, and which includes, of course, scarlet fever. And in the pre-antibiotic era, children or families used to quarantine for up to 3 weeks when you had someone with scarlet fever because it was a fatal illness. And so it was dealt with by quarantining. And but after the invention of antibiotics in the 1940s, quarantining really wasn't necessary because within 24 hours of taking your antibiotics, you were not infectious. So I'm giving this session to about 100 pediatricians in this room, and of which all but maybe three are women. There was no men involved in pediatrics pretty much there. And at the end, someone says to me, "So how long do you quarantine?" All being done through interpreters, of course. And I said, "Well, we don't actually quarantine because once you're in antibiotics, you don't need to be quarantined." Well, goodness, talk about an eruption. People were just shocked. And he said, "What are you talking about?" And I says, "Well, how long do you quarantine?" They said, "Well, 3 weeks." And of course, it was all I could do to keep them chortling and laughing because that was so outrageously misguided. But yeah, they did a lot of things that were not very understandable given our current state of medical knowledge. And they were completely cut off from the West. So that was very interesting. So then I went there, I think, 5 or 6 times, and it was mostly to Kiev, although I went to the Crimea as well. One of the things that drew me to the Ukraine is that's where my mother was born, because I'm from Ukrainian-Russian Mennonite background. So I was able to visit her birth town in southern Ukraine, which was wonderful. And I have a huge long-standing interest in history of art, and so I was able to visit the Hermitage in St. Petersburg, which was a nice plus for one of the trips. I also went on one medical teaching junket to India because I was invited to do that, to Jamshedpur, which is a big industrial city west of Calcutta. That was very satisfying. That was very satisfying because, like Uganda, you could teach in English. You didn't have to use interpreters, which was wonderful. Because the Indian medical system is all in English. And so I also went to Uganda a number of times, teaching in their hospital in Mbarara, which is about 3-hour drive southwest of the capital city, so Kampala. And that was also very satisfying and so much more. It's easier in the sense that when you don't have to use interpreters, you can communicate so much more readily with your trainees. So that was very satisfying. And I actually was on the verge of going back just a year ago. I was going to return to a program in Rwanda. I shouldn't say return. I've never been to Rwanda. But there was another program that our university is allied with in Rwanda. But then, of course, COVID came along, which has pushed that on the back burner.
Do you think practicing medicine in this way, sort of experiencing and learning the way other cultures perform medicine, changed how you viewed healthcare as a whole? And would this be something you'd recommend all doctors do at some point during their career?
Well, in my opinion, yes, because it gives you a strong empathy and understanding of the difficulties of practicing medicine outside of your medical culture. You know, even the simple thing of getting an X-ray interpreted, you know, getting an X-ray done properly, getting lab results that you can be confident about. I think it's a very healthy thing to do. Now, the standard of lab medicine in Uganda was much better than what I experienced in Ukraine. In the Ukraine, their standards were pretty shaky in the early 90s. That's improved a lot. It gave me a tremendous empathy for what our colleagues endure and have to cope with in less developed areas of the world. It really did. I feel it made me a better doctor. And also then when I'd meet families over the years from other places, there was an immediate connection, you know. My goodness, if I ever meet anybody from the Ukraine or from Uganda, like, I mean, or anybody from Africa, you know, you kind of have an instant kind of bond of a certain sort, you know. So I think it definitely was a very healthy thing to do.
So Dr. Thiessen, obviously one of the things that can't be taught in medical school is about making decisions in your home and family life. Can you give us a snapshot of what your journey looked like with your partner and children as they came along?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah. My journey wasn't probably very typical in many ways, in that we had children very early on in my career. I was in my fourth year of medical school when my first son was born. So, like, he's now like 47 years old, 48. That wasn't typical and shouldn't be typical. So that was a big stressor to have children so early on. So when we had the sick kids, my call there was pretty ruthless. I mean, I was on call 1 in 3. And you're a senior resident and you're having to spend a lot of time at the hospital. And when you're not actually in the hospital, you're also constantly preparing rounds. And as a senior resident, I was supervising a lot of juniors and medical students. And so you had to constantly be organizing rounds. And this was, of course, pre-internet. So, that was pretty stressful. So one of the strong recommendations is get a spouse that you really get along with, because she's got to put up with a lot, or he has got to put up with a lot. It was pretty stressful. But on the other hand, it also gave me a very strong, direct insight into what it's like for families managing career and children. So, yeah.
One thing I do know about you is that you're a big believer in having activities outside of work. What role did having different disciplines outside of medicine play in keeping you sharp throughout the years?
Well, I think they definitely have played an important role. I find that doing other things that are completely removed from medicine is a very healthy thing to do. I've always loved reading and art and music. And so those have all figured very significantly. I think that over 23 years ago now, a friend and I established a men's book club, which has been a very important source of nurturance and forced me to read a whole bunch of things that I wouldn't normally read. That was very helpful. And I would recommend that to anybody because, I mean, you've got to kind of like reading in order to do medicine. It's very difficult to get through your training without doing a ton of reading. So that was certainly helpful. I think being physically active is really important, and there's lots of evidence for this. I don't have to convince you that, I'm sure. And so I've always been a strong believer in maintaining daily aerobic physical activity. And there's a wonderful little book called Spark by John Ratey, who was a psychiatrist at Harvard Medical School. And the whole book it's a short, relatively short book, but it's all about exercising the brain. And I think there is very strong evidence that aerobic exercise keeps your brain sharp. And I certainly have recommended that book to many people because I think that it will make your life better. And in pediatrics, where we deal so much with attention deficit disorder, there is very strong evidence that aerobic physical activity improves your ability to concentrate and stay on task. And that's been tested in various ways, and it's true. So I strongly encourage daily aerobic physical activity, which I have not done yet this morning, I tell you, but I will.
So beyond physical activity, something else that plays a role in most people's lives is finances. Specifically, we would like to ask you how you learned as a physician how to manage finances, as it seems like this is a topic that's altogether avoided in medical education. Mm-hmm. And when did this learning curve sort of lessen for you?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Good. Very, very, very good question. Well, one of the things that I was fortunate in is that my wife is a good financial manager. So while we do make decisions mutually, she definitely does more of the actual financial management. I think MD management is an excellent resource for people going through their career. They have a lot of resources they devote to helping you as a physician manage your finances, and I would strongly lean on them. I also, and this is, again, will boil down strongly to individual people's personalities, but one of the things I decided kind of early in my career, not even as a real conscious decision probably, but that I would devote as little of my thinking time to money as I could get away with. I don't make that a priority. I don't think it's healthy overall. And I've seen too many doctors who go down the rabbit hole of constantly watching and tinkering with their investments. And I think it detracts significantly from your enjoyment of living. So I do not spend a lot of time at all wondering what my investments are doing. I try not to.
Would you like to maybe just elaborate a little bit on why you feel it detracts from your enjoyment as a physician?
Well, I think that the determination to be as rich as possible is a serious pitfall, which has been recognized since time immemorial almost, that concentrating on being wealthy definitely detracts from other things in life which I think one should spend more time on, like your family. I just don't think that it's healthy to spend a lot of your energy, but each person is an individual. And I would have to say that one of the pitfalls that I've really have tried to avoid is high-risk investments, because those really ride on people's in people's consciousness and make you think about it all the time. And I have a few colleagues over the years who spend a lot of time on that, and I don't think that that's helpful. It's not helpful for your medical practice, and it's not helpful for your mental health. So I would say that one of the most important resources you can use in this regard is lean on MD management. They have got a lot of savvy people who are very willing to give advice, and try not to devote more of your mental energy than necessary to managing your finances.
Is MD management something that also helps doctors run their own business or clinic?
Yes. Yes, they do. Yeah. Now, I had the advantage over the years of being in a group practice. And one of my bits of wisdom, as you know, Mike, from little article I wrote, Reflections from My Colleagues, is try very hard in medicine not to practice alone. I think it's a real, I'd say call it a mistake, but it's definitely a way of practicing that has a lot of pitfalls. And I would strongly urge people to try to find a situation where you can practice with others, because it'll make your life a lot easier. And definitely making mutual decisions about how to manage your practice is much easier than going it alone. So I think that... And then when your practice is large enough, like already from the time we had four or five people, we had an office manager that we could hire who basically handled the actual management of your finances in terms of making sure all the funds came into your accounts are supposed to be there and that all the delinquent accounts are followed up. And that's very helpful. So you don't have to do that yourself. Right now, our office has a really, really fine manager. And it just makes your life hugely easier, hugely easier.
That actually leads very well into our next topic we would like to talk about, which is payment methods in BC.
Right.
So for you, fee-for-service was the primary method of payment throughout your career.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts or insights on the pros and cons for this kind of model of care versus, say, the newer primary care network alternative payment plans that are starting to gain traction now?
Right. Well, I do think that alternative payment plans are a healthier way of remunerating people, personally. It doesn't give people the incentive to work as hard, I'd have to say that. But I think that it allows you to avoid what I hear complaints of from many people. Your doctor saying kind of time's up, you've got 15 minutes, don't bring more than one problem with you. And over the years, I've just been appalled to hear some people say that my doctor's got a sign in his office that says, you know, we can discuss two things and that's it or whatever. Like, I don't think that's healthy. And especially when I look at people as my parents got older, they're gone now, but they've all got multiple problems, and I just don't like that method of remuneration for people with complex issues, especially. And of course, it wouldn't work at all in running like a spinal cord clinic. We had an alternative payment plan for that, so I was given a salary for that, and that works incredibly well. So you have time to more time to spend with patients. So I do think that in the long term, alternative funding plans are the way to go. That's my feeling.
Okay, maybe now we could transition to discussing your life post-retirement. Can you run us through what maybe a typical week looks like for you in retirement?
Sure. Yeah, my typical week is that I go to my office on Mondays and see patients. I'm very fortunate that I am in a practice that lets me continue to work on one day a week. I mean, I wouldn't have to work at all, right? But I've decided to continue because I like it. So on Mondays, I see patients typically for 4 to 6 hours that they find difficult fitting into the office schedule. And because our practice is so strongly centered on newborn care, there are often newborns that go home from the hospital having had various issues or difficulties, or sometimes just perfectly normal newborns who don't have anybody to follow them up. The family doesn't have a family physician, which is pretty common these days, and or the child has special, you know, a child who's an infant who's asphyxiated at birth and spent, a week in the NICU and now needs follow-up to see how it's feeding and gaining and growing and how the parents are coping. And so we still have quite a lot of babies that need some follow-up. You know, baby had a developmental hip dysplasia or various things that aren't like acute but need follow-up. And so I still go into my office to see patients on Mondays, typically starting at 9:30 in the morning and usually leaving about 3:30, 3 or 3:30. And I just enjoy it. I love talking to parents, and you know, it is pretty easy stuff, and that it's, you know, usually not dealing with critically long-term. When I retired from my pediatric practice in July of 2019, I passed on all my chronic care patients gradually over the preceding months to my colleagues. because I didn't feel it was wise or practical to try to follow up a child who's got severe, you know, cerebral palsy or whatever in the long term. Like, I couldn't do that. So I gradually gave that up, which wasn't easy for some families. You know, you got to know some people really well, and it's not easy to just pass those on to others. So I don't see, although did I notice, I went into my EMR last night just to check to see how many patients I'm seeing on Monday, and note that my first patient I'm seeing is a four-year-old who has Klinefelter syndrome, and I had followed him from when he had an onset of seizures in the first year of life, and so he's coming back to see me, so that's fine with me, but that's not what I seek to do anymore. I'm kind of officially retired, you know. I used up the 40-year coupon.
So Mondays you're seeing patients. What about the rest of the week?
What is the rest of my week? Well, I'm taking a university course again. I took one last term on art history. I've had a lifetime interest in art history, particularly the history of the Renaissance. And so one of the advantages of being emeritus, I was a clinical professor at UBC, is that I get to take any course I want without any tuition. So you just have to get permission from the professor. And so last term I took a course in the history of the Northern European Renaissance, which is Hieronymus Bosch and friends, and this semester I am taking one on the Italian Renaissance with a wonderful professor. And I mean, it's not ideal, right? I mean, like, taking classes which are pre-recorded lectures. He has times in the week when you can talk to him, although as an articling student, I don't feel I have the right to take up much of his time, right? You know, it would be wonderful to be in class and just pop your hand up and say, you know, what about the Medicis here and there? But lots of things, like, you just can't ask it. But I am really enjoying that. And I, my actual plan for this fall had been to go to Florence for 6 weeks and study with the British Art Institute, because they do courses in Florence. But obviously that's not meant to be this year. So what else do we do? I do a lot of reading in a variety of areas, but my I do belong to this men's book club, and our we read a combination of fiction and nonfiction. And so I do keep up a lot of reading. My wife and I play tennis indoors, of course. I used to play squash a lot, but of course that's kind of been kiboshed thanks to COVID. I have no trouble filling my time. In fact, one of the things, I mean, Murphy's Law is just continually at work in your life. Everything expands to fill the time you give it, you know? And, it's insidious and it's real. So when you don't have really firm time pegs to say, I'm going to be there at 9 and I'm going to be home by 2, I'm going to da-da, time just morphs into, it's like an amoeba. It just moves into places. So my week is spent with a lot of reading and time for my wife, and yeah, I don't know. It's great. It's very enjoyable. I mean, retirement has advantages, no doubt about it.
So just to come back full circle to your discussion about your passion for continuous learning, I was wondering, how important do you think it is for a physician to have this kind of passion in order to be successful in their career?
Well, I guess it's important to define what you mean by successful, I guess. I think in terms of having a satisfying career, I think it's really important, you know. I think the things in my career that have been most enjoyable for me have been the ones related to teaching, and particularly to running the journal club in the Canadian Pediatric Society annually. That was which basically was a strong incentive to keep up with the literature, you know. Because if there's anything that's going to make your life more interesting as a doctor, it's keeping on the edge of what's evolving in medicine. You know, that's important. It makes you a better doctor, and it just makes your career more interesting. Like right now, the use of artificial intelligence in medicine is a hot topic. The use of point-of-care ultrasound in ER and in the neonatal intensive care unit, hot topics. So I think that keeping up with literature is a really, really important way to give you interest in life. And I really encourage that. I'll put a plug in here for if right early in your career, download the app Read by QXMD. It's free, and you can configure it to your UBC proxy library proxy server so that you can then go into Read and pull up any article that the library stocks, any journal that the article library stocks, you've got at your fingertips. So I would really encourage you to use that. That app has been hugely helpful to me in the last 5 to 7 years. The other thing that you should try to do early in your career is pick a couple of medical journals that you want to keep abreast of. In pediatrics, it's easy. There's probably about 10, but of which I only, you know, 3 or 4 are the main ones, like pediatrics or Journal of Pediatrics. And then get them to send you their index each month, which they will do without any payment. And then you can go to the library and pull up the journal articles that you actually want to read. So I think keeping up with the literature is a really important way of keeping up your interest in medicine.
So at this point, I'd love to be able to ask you a few more general questions. And without framing things in terms of, you know, regrets in life, I'm just curious, if you were to look back now in hindsight, would you have done anything differently in your career?
Yeah, I've often thought about that. Kierkegaard said that life is only understood looking backwards, but must be lived looking forwards. You know, you don't really understand things until you've experienced them. You know, in one word, no, I wouldn't do anything differently. You know, I really wouldn't. I mean, sometimes I have envied people who have a clear academic focus, like somebody who does endocrinology. And I really considered for a period of time after I'd done my year of neonatal training in the 70s when I returned from SickKids, being a neonatologist. That did interest me briefly, you know, to become really specialized in some area. But I derived so much satisfaction out of being a more general pediatrician that I've never regretted that. But I did give that some passing consideration to focus down and become a subspecialist rather than just a pediatrician. So I think in one word, no, I wouldn't do anything differently. And I think becoming very involved with the work of the Canadian Pediatric Society and the BC Pediatric Society was something I would encourage anybody to do, is devote some of your time to giving your time to other things for which you're not remunerated, right? I mean, I never get any money from the CPS. They pay my way when it was possible to fly to meetings. You know, I would get my way paid. But give your time to other things because it's very satisfying. Very satisfying.
So in that vein of career satisfaction, what sort of advice would you give to early trainees, kind of like us, for finding the most success and satisfaction out of our careers and also our lives, I suppose?
Mm-hmm. That's a very, very good question, which I guess ties into would I do anything differently, right? I mean, I think that one of the things I would really advise is early in your training, keep up with the current medical literature. I've already said that, but I think that is a hugely important way of keeping your interests piqued and your focus sharp. Is keep up what's evolving. And that's really an important way of keeping up your interest. Because that's the only way you're going to get long-term satisfaction, and it's going to make you a better doctor. So that's definitely something I would advise everyone to do, is keep up with your reading. And that's all. Also, of course, keep up with your reading outside of medicine too. You know, I mean, you know, read for fun, and read widely. You know, and I think it really helps to have developed some additional focus of interest. You know, if it's restoring cars or doing crafts or playing a musical instrument. I mean, it's one of my, you know, two of my big life regrets are I never learned to play a musical instrument and I never learned another language except for German, which isn't a very useful language, as much as the Germans like it to be. So, I think 300,000, 30,000 foot view of what I would advise is just keep interested in things and keep reading. And I mean, I guess one of the other things I would suggest is develop friendships outside of medicine. You know, I think that's really helpful too. You know, my best friend is an anthropologist. He was a medical anthropologist in the last part of his career, mind you, but he's an anthropologist. And and previously my best friend who died in cancer 10 years ago, he was a lawyer who became a businessman. And I think it's really helpful to have friends who aren't doctors. Having said that, four out of the guys in my men's book club are doctors.
Yeah, do as you say, not as you do.
Exactly. Because, of course, you naturally gravitate to people that you're seeing a lot of, right? I mean, that's just natural. Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, so from the perspective of 40 years of practice, do you have a single sort of achievement or accomplishment that you're most proud of?
Well, one of the things I was pretty proud of, I mean, I guess probably one of them was establishing that ward at Women's Hospital for the care of mothers and infants with substance use. That's unique in Canada. And but that, and I definitely don't take credit that the force behind that was a family doctor named Ron Abrahams, who really put his weight behind it. And we had the fortune of having a CEO at Women's Hospital at the time, Liz Wynot, who was very sympathetic because she had been a family doctor who had worked in the downtown East Side. And so establishing that ward was a particular satisfaction. And I was the medical director of the nurseries at the time when the ward opened. And so that was a hugely career satisfying thing to do. I guess one of the other things earlier, you people just have no idea. You have very vague memories, I think, of what it was like to have smoking around all the time, including in hospitals. And so getting smoking out of hospitals was a huge undertaking. It took about 10 years. And I was one of the three or four physicians at Children's and Women's who was on the forefront of eliminating smoking from the hospital. And it seems like such an easy thing now to, of course, I mean, why would you allow smoking in a hospital? Well, it was, including when the new Children's Hospital opened in 1983, when you came off the elevators on the third floor, right in front of you was you were in a smoking lounge. There was little couches and you could sit there and smoke openly. It seems like a journey in space now, you know, like being on another planet, but, and so
alternate universe.
Exactly. And so getting smoking out of the hospitals was a massive, a big undertaking, including when we got down to the last, that took about 10 years. When we got down to the last smoking lounge, which was beside the intensive care unit at Children's Hospital, the thinking was this. You know, if you've got a child who's on a ventilator because they've just been in a car accident, that is no time to make a parent stop smoking. That's unkind. And then when we got the last cigarette vending machine out of the hospital, another major effort, I was on the medical advisory committee at the time, the thinking was, well, you know, in the middle of a cold November evening when it's raining, it's so cruel to make parents walk three blocks to the shopping center at the corner of Oak and Broadway, of Oak and 25th to get their cigarettes. Like, that's just not kind. And so you can always frame things in different ways. So that smoking removal effort was a major kind of thrust in that part of my career. Felt pretty satisfied when that was over, but it was a pretty bruising journey, actually.
Yeah, that's a pretty incredible story because, you know, I'm old enough to remember going to a restaurant and then them asking if you like the smoking or non-smoking section. And, you know, nowadays it's just such a foreign concept. It's incredible to think that, you know, there you really had to go through those kind of motions to change the culture at large.
My middle son, Matt, at the time, we'd go into a restaurant and there'd be smoking somewhere and somebody could see somebody smoking. And when he was like maybe 11, 12, he would just hold on to my arm and say, "Dad, please just don't say anything. Don't say anything." Live in terror of being humiliated.
Oh, man, poor little guy. So just in our last couple of minutes here, I'm wondering if you have any sort of final warnings or admonishments for the next generation of doctors?
Well, I guess one of my admonishments would be don't be too enthralled by the pharmaceutical industry. You know, I think that's a significant pitfall. One of the things that I did early in my career, starting probably within the first 3 or 4 months, is I stopped seeing pharmaceutical, that's not true, but the first 2 years, was I stopped seeing any pharmaceutical reps. I didn't think that, didn't seem like a wise way to get information. They'd always bring you lunch, right? And they were always nice people and good to chat with, but I just didn't think that was very wise. And in retrospect, I think it's absolutely true. And so if I have any advice, is be very cagey about your relationships with big pharma, because they're out to make money for their shareholders. One book that I've read quite a number of books around these issues, and one of them is called Drugs for Life by Joseph Dumit, or Dumit, D-U-M-I-T, I think, Drugs for Life. And the thrust of the book is that a pharmaceutical company's primary interest is not to give you a drug that cures you so much as to give you a drug that you have to keep taking. And so a good example probably is drugs for ADD, where it's common to give these drugs to children in their mid to late childhood. And then generally most people wean off of them or stop them by the time they're in their teens or early 20s. And now there's a strong thrust to make people consider that these are drugs for life. And so I guess one of my admonitions is definitely to keep a gentle but careful distance from big pharma. And definitely, regardless of what medicine you do, don't meet pharmaceutical reps in your office. I mean, I think that's just a good general principle, is don't meet pharmaceutical. That's not the place to get your information. You know, and then some doctors say, yeah, but that's how we get samples that I can then give to people who can't afford them. I say, yeah, but by and large, it's been shown that that doesn't save people money, because that they have to make that up somehow. And so that's one of my admonitions, is keep your distance from big pharma.
Thanks. I think that's a great reminder. Do you have any examples of how that might play out on sort of an institutional level?
So early in my career, when I was doing a lot of leadership stuff with the BC Pediatric Society and the Canadian Pediatric Society, we had to wrestle with, and especially when I chaired the annual meetings committees, you know, we had to wrestle with, how much money do we accept from these people? And what form should it be in? You know, like, it was very common when I was first doing this in the 90s for pharmaceutical companies to host a dinner and pay for your, you know, pay for your wine and dine you. And then I just, you know, a lot of us felt that this wasn't right, because it does powerfully influence you. If somebody buys you a glass of wine, you are in their debt in a certain way. And you know this with gift giving of any kind. And they're not stupid. They're very smart about marketing. And so we gradually, and our BC Pediatric Society was very strong in this direction. We stopped accepting pharmaceutical dinners and things like that. We just didn't want to be indebted to people.
Well, that's great advice, I think. And that's sort of how we found ourselves in the opioid crisis in the first place.
Exactly, yeah. And the final bit of wisdom I'd leave you is read a few books like How Doctors Think by Jerome Groopman. Terrific book, written about 12 years ago now, about how doctors make decisions and how doctors make mistakes. Very, very good book. How Doctors Think. It's been one of the most influential books I've read in the last 15 years on the practice of medicine. he's an oncologist from Harvard, I think, or from, well, Eastern United States anyway. And that was a very, very fine read. It's entertaining, too. Like, it's funny in places. But how doctors think.
Well, it's been lovely talking to you, Dr. Thiessen. Thank you so much for joining us.
Okay, wish we could meet at the pub. But that will come back.
That could be your 2022 interview.
Yeah, exactly. All right.
And as always, thank you to you, our listeners, for joining us today. To find more from Metamorphosis, search us up on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you find your podcasts. Until next time, wishing you your best health.
This has been a presentation of the UBC Medicine Learning Network.
The Aboriginal Front Door Society is a culturally safe, peer-designed, non-judgmental place for Aboriginal peoples, their friends and their family in the downtown Eastside. It's an accessible space where Aboriginal folks can experience, learn and participate in traditional Aboriginal culture, teachings and ceremonies as part of their healing journey through life. Right now, they're accepting donations of food and warm clothing, which are needed more than ever as residents of the downtown Eastside face the challenges of COVID-19 and winter weather. If you're able to help, you can drop your donation off at 384 Main Street on weekdays between 9 a.m. and 2 p.m. That is 384 Main Street. To learn more about the Aboriginal Front Door Society and other ways that you can support their work, please visit abfrontdoor.org.
Discover Noreen Braun's album, Songs for Trees, dedicated to the forest and the spirits within the trees. As we fight climate change, trees are the lungs of the planet and we need to help them. Her jazz and blues are blended with rock and synthesized pop elements to create a textured and ambient soundtrack to nature. Songs for Trees is a narrative, with each song guiding us through a journey through the forest. A trip, literally and metaphorically, about the interconnectedness of all things. The Vancouver Sun names it one of five albums you need to hear. Find out more at noreenbraun.com. Going to the forest.